Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. James Strang could be the boldest con man in American history. That's the case that Miles Harvey makes in his book, The King of Confidence, a tale of utopian dreamers, frontier schemers, true believers, false prophets, and the murder of an American monarch. Miles viewed Strang as a lightning rod for all of the excesses of the mid-19th century, the intense religious and social movements, and the apocalyptic fears. Miles' book tells the stranger-than-fiction life story of how Strang became a congressman, the head of the Mormon Church, and an enemy of the state, all after faking his death and having to flee from rural New York in the summer of 1843.
He tried to be a country lawyer. He tried to be a newspaper man. He was a postmaster for a while, and this was vital to his education, kind of as a con man, but he kind of failed at all those things. But what he was good at kind of blew up on him. He sold some land in Ohio that didn't exist, supposedly, and the guy who had bought the land came back to Western New York and said, hey, that land doesn't exist. And so Strang, according to newspaper reports at the time, got out of town in a hurry and, in fact, faked his own death, which was a fairly common thing. And then another common thing he did was go west to establish a whole new persona, a whole new identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he shows up 600 miles away in Burlington, Wisconsin, which, of course, is the hometown of Antonio Ramiro Romo, or Tony Romo, as he's better known. Why did Strang end up here?
He wound up in Burlington, Wisconsin, because he had a good friend there and a set of friends. And these guys had gone out and made a claim in this little town about 60 miles southwest of Chicago. Well, it wasn't even a town then. It was just a piece of land, even before Wisconsin was a territory. And many of his friends there were these Mormons. He grew up around some Mormons. His closest friend was ostensibly a Mormon. He claimed to be an atheist. Until 1844, when he went to the town of Nauvoo, which it was then as big a town as Chicago. It was on the Mississippi River. It was the hub of the Mormon Church. He went there. He met Joseph Smith, the founder and prophet of the Mormon Church, and converted to Mormonism, supposedly. Whether or not it was a real conversion, I can't say. But he went back to this little town of Burlington, and shortly thereafter, Smith was shot and killed by an anti-Mormon mob. And shortly after that, Strang produced a letter saying that Smith had turned over the entire Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to him, James Jesse Strang, which would sort of be like turning the, since we're on the Tony Romo metaphor, turning over the entire Dallas Cowboys to a fourth-round draft pick who's on your taxi squad, you know? I mean, Strang's letter really didn't convince a lot of people, but he stuck with it. And eventually, in Burlington, this little town in Wisconsin, he dug up some brass plates, much like the plates Smith had dug up in New York. And these plates, you're going to be shocked, Doug, were written in a language that only one person on earth had the ability to read, thanks to a miracle. That person was James Jesse Strang. And you're going to be even more shocked, Doug, that those plates sort of further proclaimed Strang the head of this church. And so eventually Strang built a pretty big following, both in the what we now call the Midwest, which was then the West, period. We didn't call it our region the Midwest until 50 years later, but also across the country. And he eventually became the biggest rival to Brigham Young for control of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was around this time that newspapers were becoming more popular, and Strang was able to exploit this growing popularity to create a national reputation for himself. How exactly did he do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that the King of Confidence, it's mysterious for 21st century readers to understand how this guy could gain such a large following. But he was brilliant, among other things, at manipulating the media. He understood this boom in the newspaper business. There was this boom of newspapers all over the country, and there was a new speed to the news. The telegraph had just come in, but there was also the railroad. News was traveling faster. But there was also this system of exchange papers, they called it. It's from the Postal Act of, I think, 1792, that newspapers could exchange papers for free. So papers were literally getting in hundreds of other newspapers a month. And what they would do is they would take these newspapers and they would clip out stories from these newspapers and they would put them in their own paper. It was sort of like before the wire service, but it's very much news getting transferred in that decentralized way like we now see in Facebook and Twitter. And Strang was brilliant about understanding the system. He had been a newspaper editor in New York. His newspaper had flopped. But the first thing he did when he started a new sect in Wisconsin and later on Beaver Island in the middle of Lake Michigan was to start a newspaper. And he would send out his news from the farthest limits of the frontier, and he would get it reprinted in papers all over the country and all over the world, because he knew just how to spin an article that made it sound like this quirky story from the frontier. So, I mean, he was getting covered by newspapers in England, in Australia. I mean, the guy was absolutely brilliant. I think that that's one of the things that's really interested me about this in terms of technology, is that often these guys who we think of as con men were really brilliant about technology, and Strang was definitely one of those people.
He moved the headquarters of the church to Beaver Island in Lake Michigan in 1848. Why did he do this?
So there are a few reasons. In Burlington, he initially drew like a lot of leaders of the church. You know, he was not just popular among the masses, but he drew some real close followers of Smith's and some higher-ups in the church. But when they got to Burlington, a lot of these people tended to sour on him and see him as a fraud. And they stuck around town and made his life miserable. The other thing was he found that he couldn't keep followers there. People, he'd go on these tours of the East Coast and he'd be very impressive and he'd recruit people to this prairie town and they'd get out there and he didn't seem quite the miraculous person that he'd made himself out to be. And life on the frontier in Wisconsin was rough back then. And so I think Strang realized he needed a place where he could have more controls of the coming and goings. The other thing was he set up a pirate colony on Beaver Island. And his move to Beaver Island was both, I think, very smart in terms of politics, but I think it also gave him much more control of his people. We know from modern cult theory that one of the things you do is isolate people, and that certainly did it. But it also, if you're going to set up a pirate colony, an island is a great place to do it.
Mm-hmm. It was on Beaver Island that Strang crowned himself the king of earth and heaven, right? Did he do that just to satisfy his own ego, or was there some more strategy involved in it?
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer to it, but I think he did it like kings have since the beginning of civilized society to firm up his power, right? And I think also he wrote in these wonderful diaries that he kept when he was a late teenager and in his early 20s, he wrote about what he called my dreams of royalty and power. And he was just a little farm boy in New York at that time, a country lawyer. I mean, it's amazing his ambition and ego and, you know, we might say now in retrospect, narcissism. But he really believed that he was set out for something. At one point, he talks about Princess Victoria, you know, who we now think of as Queen Victoria. And he says, if I could just meet her, I know I'd marry her and become King of England. I think he took being a king seriously, and we can laugh at it now, but I mean, I think one of the things to really keep in mind, Doug, is that the U.S. president, Millard Fillmore, also took it seriously enough to have a quasi-independent kingdom on U.S. soil, that he sent in the Navy's first iron-hulled warship to invade Beaver Island and bring Strang to justice.
Wow. So Strang also served as a member of the Michigan House of Representatives. Did he accomplish anything during his political career?
Yeah. He was actually a very good lawmaker in a lot of ways, and even his worst enemies thought so. So after he was arrested by the federal government, he was brought to trial in Detroit, he and many of his followers, and they were found innocent, in part because he was just gave a great speech to the court. He eventually, through fraud, gets himself elected to the Michigan legislature, not once, but twice. And people there are like, wow, this guy is a great speaker. He's organized. He's a good writer. He's really impressive. And one of the things he really fought for, and I think it's the one thing that Strang really believed in, was abolitionism. So he, while in the Michigan legislature, fought hard against the 1850 fugitive slave law. He helped the brand new Republican Party, which had just swept into office, fight this federal law, which demanded that Northerners assist Southern slave catchers in bringing slaves back to justice. And he also just fought hard for African-American rights. He ordained a black elder in his church almost 130 years before the mainstream branch, the Brighamite branch of Mormonism, did it. And so he was way, way ahead of his time and way, way ahead of his contemporaries in the church on race.
Hmm. Strang was assassinated on Beaver Island on June 16th, 1856. What happened?
Well, like many of the stranger than fiction tales of this story, one of the big ostensible reasons for his murder was that he had ordered that all women on the island wear pantaloons, which are like pajama pants. But a lot of people objected to the wearing of bloomers. Eventually, I think it kind of became like masks are in our own culture right now, this symbol of loyalty. Mm-hmm. If you were loyal to Strang, you wore bloomers or had your wife wear bloomers. And if you were against Strang, you refused to wear pantaloons and encouraged your wife not to wear pantaloons. And so eventually, he just said, no, you will wear pantaloons. And eventually, there was a plot to kill him, and he was assassinated by his own people with the help, probably, of the U.S. government and the state of Michigan in 1856.
Would you mind reading the last paragraph of your book?
Sure. I should preface this by saying there's a woman in here mentioned. Her name is Elvira, and she was Strang's first plural wife, and she was an extraordinary person. But when Strang died, she believed that he would come back to life. She really believed that he was a true prophet of God and a miraculous person. People like James Strang never really vanish. When the time is right, they reappear, wearing a new guise, exploiting new fears, offering new dreams of salvation. Americans are fixated on such figures, especially in periods of profound social and economic upheaval. And so it is that Elvira's desperate hope for her husband to return from the dead has come true. So it is that the King of Confidence lives on.
When I read that paragraph, I interpreted it as you making a direct connection between James Strang and President Donald Trump. Was that something you were trying to do there?
That's as close as I get to it in the entire book. I don't make that comparison, that link, in the book, anywhere in the book. I make two oblique references, one at the beginning of the book and the one you just heard. But my time writing this book overlaps almost exactly with the Trump era, from his announcement, his campaign, his election, his presidency. I guess I woke up every morning thinking about Strang and went to sleep every night thinking about Trump. And our times are similar, not exact, but it is a time when, as we talked about earlier, reality is porous now. And I saw the book. I guess what I would say, Doug, is that I would have written a different book in a different time period. And, you know, I think that I'm an English professor, so I'm into the humanities. And I think one of the things the humanities do, and I'm really passionate about this, is that by studying the past, we can learn about the present and the future, and we can make sense of the present and the future. And so I'm glad if people can use the King of Confidence to sort of sort through our own times and through what the historian Barbara Tuchman once called a distant mirror, this idea that the past offers this distant reflection into our own times. And it's not an exact one, but it helps us think through our own period.
Miles Harvey, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a blast.
Miles Harvey is the author of The King of Confidence, a tale of utopian dreamers, frontier schemers, true believers, false prophets, and the murder of an American monarch. Find out more at WPR.org. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Matt Berninger, Adam Naiman, and Miles Harvey. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
I have a love in my life that makes me stronger than anything you can imagine.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I mean, it's one thing to hear it from Buck's mouth. It's another thing to hear it from the TK421.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I drink your milkshake.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you again next week. Take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
I am firing pearls at you here.